So what we're going to talk about, we actually had a very rousing discussion in there. We didn't quite get to blows, which was good. So I think we're mostly still friends here. But what we're going to talk about, we're going to talk about bots. And so intelligent bots, less intelligent bots, applications for, what's going on with them, et cetera. So I'm going to let each of the panelists kind of introduce themselves, kind of where they are in this space, and then we'll get going from there.
Hello. Can you hear me okay? Yeah, great. So I'm Bikram Dendi. I work at Microsoft, more specifically Microsoft Research. But I work on the part of Microsoft Research that's focused on projects. So I focus on taking great research technologies and bringing them to folks like you, to end users. And so Bot Framework is one of the projects that we've incubated out of my part of the world. Great to be here.
Cool. Hi, everybody. My name is Amir Shvat. Can you hear me?
Yep.
OK, sound check. I'm the head of developer relations in Slack. And I help developers and startups build cool Slack apps and bots. Before that, I was in Google and in Microsoft. So happy to be here.
Hi, I'm Crystal Rose, and I'm the co-founder of Sensei. Sensei is the most helpful person you've never met. So you can think of Sensei like the world's first invisible social network. It's a network of bots that connects humans together through any messenger, including SMS. So we built a really cool product in Slack.
Thank you.
So yeah, very cool. So let's start with one of the more basic questions. So we just went through a very quick, from the very beginning to where we are today in the room together. But let's kind of go back and say, so I want to hear how you define a bot, and can you give an example that people might be familiar with today? And why don't we start with you?
Sure. So I think that today bots and AI are words that are being used interchangeably. So I'd like to make a differentiation of the two of those things. So AI fundamentally is machine learning, and bots can operate without being smart. So bots do have the potential of being dumb. They're something that can service to get you what you need faster. It can be something that makes searching or navigation easier. It can make a workflow easier. A bot is really something that can sit inside of another application layer, and we think of them in terms of two types. One is a pull, and one is a push. You either are having information pulled from you, from the bot, or you're pulling things to it, or it's pushing things to you. So I think a good example of this, a simple push bot might be a publication that is sending you constant news updates in Facebook. We've seen some of those come out. And Sensei is an example of a pull bot. So when you need to talk to someone about something or need someone to do something for you, you can ping Sensei and you can pull a human right back into a chat with you.
So I think that bots, first of all, I totally agree that bots and AI are totally different. People mistaken them to be the same thing. I think bots are one way to expose your service in a conversational interface. There are multiple ways to expose your service. You can expose them through apps, you can expose them through people like answering phones, and you can expose them through conversational interface like Slack and like other platforms. I think that bots are just one of the ways to expose your service. And a lot of people mistakenly say that I need this, I need a bot. Bot is a good hammer, but not everything is a nail. So think of a bot as one of the ways to expose your service.
Yeah.
Can you give us one example of like an interesting bot that's built on a Slack interface, for example?
So, I love Sensei. I love I use Howdy for product management. AwesomeBot is also awesome. not on Slack. I use X.AI, which I really really love. So Amy Ingram saves me about 150 emails a week. For those of you who don't know, Amy Ingram, X.AI is a service that lets you schedule meetings with other people. It's usually very complex and very cumbersome, and it's amazing service. I think one of the key amazing things is that the way people interact with Amy, they send it thank you letters CCing me. So it's like the way you can create a delightful service, that's awesome.
And Amy is an integration of AI and humans. So there's a pretty large percentage of human intervention currently with X.AI that over their roadmap will go down. And I think that's a really good example of where, this convergence of human, AI, and bot, like where do those things belong together.
Yeah, and this is actually a really good way of thinking about bots in the context of today. It's really about those conversations and that way, what is very natural for you when you interact with one of these services. There are not all services you need a bot for, you need a conversation interface for. Bots are a little overloaded term just because, it's derived from robots and we've seen lots of movies in which,
Beam me up, Scotty.
Yeah, so because of that, I think people overload that term quite a bit. And you all know, if you have a website, you all see the bots that come and crawl your web page. So those are also bots. So in the context that I think what we are talking about, in the context of combining AI-powered experiences with bots, those are really more about conversations and about natural user experiences. And so conversation as an interface paradigm is what is most interesting to me right now about bots.
So I think that's interesting. So let's stay on the conversation piece for a second, because one of the things we didn't get a chance to discuss is that 10 years ago, people were talking about agent frameworks, mm-hmm. right? And the notion was, today, you have to go somewhere on the web, right? You are physically tied to the browser. You've got to go figure out. These conversational interfaces to services becomes a very interesting thing, right? It's work that can be done on your behalf. Mm-hmm. And so can you guys talk a little bit about how do you see that going, that conversational interface as being a way to maybe relieve users of that kind of now, today, I have to do this kind of experience and having work done on their behalf, I guess. Yep. And you gave a great example of the email one. What are some of the other things you see in that kind of space?
Yeah, I think there is actually lots of positive things here, but there's also a word of caution here. So on the conversational side, if you want to order a pizza, today, the best way to order a pizza, especially if you want like lots of customizations, is to call them. But at the same time, in the world where Uber has become so popular because people don't want to talk to other people, there is also value in figuring out how do you kind of find that middle ground. And in the past, conversational interfaces were actually very bad at doing anything sophisticated. And so now, we are starting to see experiences, even simple experiences, that actually continue to stay simple, but actually do very sophisticated work. So that's, I think, the place where we have the sweet spot for bots. So the caution is, if you just decide to do bots for bots' sake, like, I need to have a bot, you often will actually make it much harder for your users. And that's not a good place to go.
Yeah, so, Vikram, I think you said it best about it. A bot needs to make things easier. And so conversation is the most natural thing that we do. And naturally, everything is moving that way. We have Siri, and we have the Amazon Echo. We see that we want to be able to interface with our technology through conversation. It is the most natural way to do it. I actually do talk to my Uber drivers because they're very knowledgeable. I had a dolphin trainer, an Emmy winner. I live in LA. So, very interesting humans. On the human side, it is important that we maintain sort of that human dignity while letting AI come into our lives. But I think bots, when you can order a pizza in less steps that is more accurate or better than you can by picking up the phone with a bot, that's where it wins.
So for us, it's really easy because there's a lot of sucky business processes. How many of you like to do expense reports? Like one hand, right? like there's expense reports, travel, a lot of business processes are right now very cumbersome and very complex and could be easily, and there is a minority in our organization that actually has a personal assistant, right? Our VPs, our SVPs have personal assistant, and they don't do expense report like we do, right? And they don't do their travel arrangement the way we do, right? And we're laughing, right? It's something that we all want to have. Yeah. So I think that the promise here is that we can make everyone a VP. I'm sure all of you will become a VP in next year because you'll have all these delightful personal assistances in your business. So that's the promise.
So there is a generational shift happening too. If you look at your younger brothers or your children, if you have them, you're starting to see people wanting to be asynchronous, right? Like a lot of activities have become async. No one wants to actually like have just a focused conversation with one person. And so bots and technologies like this, a lot of these are kind of trends in that direction to give you the opportunity to kind of do things somewhat asynchronously. And so that's another thing that we are seeing with this particular paradigm.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. You also remind me, so my executive assistants out there somewhere. Vanessa, you do a great job. I want to thank you again for all the things I don't have to do. I appreciate that. Thank you. You reminded me. But that asynchronous thing. So this leads me to another conversation. I was having a conversation with somebody a few weeks ago, and they talked about we're headed for a world with many asynchronous shallow conversations, but few deep ones. Mm-hmm. Where is the technology today to enable some of those deeper conversations? And is that something we'll see in the next couple of years, or is that just a really long way off? Because I think everybody here can see the value of those shallow conversations happening more efficiently.
Yeah.
Have you ever had a conversation with AI? Have you used the chatbots? So chatbots have been around for about 18 years. There's actually one called Mitsuku that's very popular. You can use her in a lot of the chat apps today, like Telegram or Facebook. If you have a conversation with a chatbot, it's usually really hilarious by like the third line. In China, 20 million people use a chatbot in order to tell their deepest secrets and emotional woes and joys. So if you have talked to a bot, you do have very shallow conversations in that when it's giving things back to you, you know for a fact that it's not human. The true solution to that right now that we have is human conversation. And so Sensei is a layer on top of messengers that puts humans together at the point at which you really need a person. I think that AI is going to come in and take a lot of the repetitive tasks and do a really good job at it. A lot of the things, even HR reps are going to have a great time with things like Tala coming out, where they get to see dossiers within their Slack channels. They can get the meetings organized more easily within their teams. I think business processes are going to radically transform with AI. But when it comes to deep human emotional connections, we're going to still need to connect to another human for a very long time until we've trained the AI by way of them analyzing our conversations, how to have better conversations with us.
Blade Runner is coming to mind, sorry.
I totally agree. There is a study by IBM that shows that they could predict sentiment at the accuracy of 75% sentiment analysis accuracy, which is probably better than my ability to predict sentiment when I'm talking to my wife. I don't know. So there is a potential to have deeper conversation and maybe in a few years, but I agree that we're very, very far away from that. And I would stipulate that you probably don't need that, right? For 90% of what you need to do, for what you're going to do in the next couple of years, you don't need these like deep conversation. What you need is like getting stuff done fast and more accurate. If it's not gonna do that, then bots will become the blinking text of 1995, where every website you went had like, hey, I'm an animated GIF and stuff like that. So please be mindful with your bots.
So the example that Crystal gave of the chatbot in China, where people are, you know, saying "I love you" and you know, spending all their time sitting on the toilet talking to this bot. So it's called Xiao Eyes, and you know, it's a partnership between our team and our Bing team in China. And what's been very fascinating about that is, yes, I mean, there is a lot of shallow conversation. It provides companionship. There is, you know, fun. It's just an ongoing conversation thing. Sometimes, you know, it pretends to be a virtual boyfriend or a girlfriend when your parents are pressuring you for to get married. Apparently, it's a big problem in China. So, but the places where I think it delights people are places where it really truly uses some kind of more deeper transformative technology to synthesize information out of large amounts of data. Learn about, like, you know, we have a very cute app called Fetch, which you can install, and it actually can detect whether it's a dog or not, and what kind of dog it is, and if it's actually a human that you're taking a picture of, it kind of switches to fun mode and kind of tells you what kind of dog you are. And this functionality is integrated into Xiao Eyes, so it's actually very interesting for people, and it's not just, you know, it's not randomly picking, right? It's actually doing a little bit of visual analysis and processing. So when you can use technology to really delight the person or surprise the person about something that, you know, technology can do for you that, say, a human being would take a long time to do, for example, those are the situations where you actually are augmenting an experience. So that's the example around how you can kind of enhance these experiences with deep technology. The flip side of that is, you know, we did the speech translation technology, the Skype translator, And we had to go the complete opposite direction. We had to basically obscure the technology when we delivered the experience. The entire goal of that was, how do we make the technology blend into the background, right? Like, you don't want to have a bot sitting in the middle and trying to be, trying to have a personality and trying to be human and connect with you. It's really trying to just get out of the way and allow you to communicate what it is that you want to do between, say, a grandmother and a grandchild who are in different countries. So this puts a big emphasis on design. And I think there are people here with superpowers in product, superpowers in development, maybe superpowers in research, but there has to be people with superpowers in design that are thinking about conversational interfaces. And that's one of the key learnings that we had in building experiences.
Well, we're finally getting to the point where we have interface elements in conversation, thanks to products like Slack and like other messengers, Telegram and others that are giving us buttons in stream and things to play with. I think it's really interesting, you know, what you said with the way that we augment ourselves and become better. So that's a good way to think about bots. Bots are something that that we augment ourselves with to do things faster, and AI is augmented to do it better. And so AI can actually augment us. I think if you look at like human-assisted artificial intelligence especially, we are uplifting our abilities, and bots just make it sort of faster to get things done. It's more like a utility.
So can you think, just along those lines, specifically following up on that, can you think of interfaces where you're seeing people starting to explore putting bots on the front end of a service that maybe it's not applicable? Like, you'll get and go, that's making it less efficient, less easy.
Yes. So anything that you can tap one button to do, stay there for the moment. Yeah. Uber in conversational format is not very efficient. So several attempts have been made at this. You can use it in any, let's say, SMS or a text-based format. You have to tell it where you are. There's no, you know, geolocation. We all know the benefits of Uber. If you've taken me more steps to get to the outcome I'm desiring than the original thing that was a solution, maybe it's not so bad to download an app. Certainly, you know, apps have their place, but yes, layering bots on top of everything is not the key and the silver bullet.
I think even within the conversational user experience, there are things that are not bots that could be very useful. For example, a lot of, like, the majority of our integrations are now notifications, which is just piping content. I want to know about a certain event when it happens, and maybe I want to act in it, so I'll add buttons to that notification, right? So there's no bots were hurt in the making of that application, and you can actually facilitate a great service through conversation interface. Slash commands are like turning like our conversational interface into a command line for services instead of a bot. A bot is useful when you need context. When you need context and when there's like and when there's a follow-up and a lot of complexity, that's where a bot could be helpful.
Yeah, and bots are not, I mean, don't treat bots in isolation, right? Like, a lot of times when you set out saying, oh, I'm going to build a bot to do this, if along the way you realize that you could actually do it much more, some aspect of it much more easily with something else, mix them, right? There's actually a really good way in which you can actually have bots interact with apps, interact with web pages. So, I mean, bot's just one tool that you have. And so don't write a bot that writes code for you, for example. Like, I've had somebody tell me that, you know, they're going to build a bot that writes code for you.
Probably not going to happen.
Yeah.
Bots are great for information gathering. So at a base level, if you look at something like Typeform was the first one to give us a field individually at one time so that it's not such a big endeavor to fill out something massive. Yeah. You kind of get the baby steps. But it also had logic built in. So you answer one way and you get taken down another path and another way. I think so for navigation and for information gathering, bots are great. If you can figure out how to integrate something like that, where it's just an ease of use and a better overall user experience, absolutely, that's something to put into your app.
So the other thing that I've and this is just a comment. So the other thing I've seen, so we have a personal assistant like Siri, Cortana, that sits on Windows for us. She does, and it's a she to me, so I'm going to call it a she. She does all my scheduling for me now, right? So, and I have not missed a plane out of San Francisco in the last 8 months because she's now telling me when to leave my house, right? So that level of intelligence is really useful.
Yeah.
But what I do get back sometimes from other interfaces is a constant stream of information where the information is what I want to know, but there's no context about when I'm receiving it, yep. how I'm receiving it. So it's yep. just, I almost better just getting it through an app or a stream, right? Yep. So let's shift this a second. So I want to dive into Sensei and Slack for just a minute. So let's take a minute, just talk about Sensei, the underlying kind of technology, what you're willing to talk about. What makes it unique? What are you bringing to the market that kind of you saw this opportunity? Because this is all about startups. What is it that you think that you've really kind of nailed? And where do you see, like, what are the people going to be surprised about 6 months from you guys?
Yeah, I'm surprised every single day by Sensei. So I actually learned how to code when I was 11 through the original chatbot, which was AOL Instant Messenger. And it was from a complete stranger. So I had met people in chat rooms and found that you could easily get information and learn things and find mentors. You could do other things too. But in naivety, you go into these things looking for how to learn. So Sensei sort of brings that back around. What we've built is a platform that both matches humans together and routes them based on relevant needs and life experience. So if you have an intent, you put your need into Sensei, and it will find the right human, no matter what messenger they're on, and bring them back to a chat with you totally anonymously. And when you've had a conversation, you can optionally give them a tip. So the core underlying platform of Sensei is really about indexing everyone's knowledge and life experience, helping them connect together faster through any method, whatever that is. So bots happen to be the fastest way that we've found today, and messengers happen to be the most delightful and useful way that people have. We started in SMS, which is the messenger that's the most ubiquitous. It's the one that everyone has and everyone uses. And I think that the thing that's going to really surprise us is as we all embark on this journey to start adding as many bots as we can to our messengers because they all seem cool and fun, we will get a lot of shallow experiences. We will see that that it is a human that we are really after, and that the humans are what are going to provide a really great experience for us.
Yeah, this is a common pattern. We have a few apps in Slack that connect between humans and humans to add an anonymity or to add indexing or search like you provide. So this is a common pattern to have, like, the bot is a relay between two humans that are disconnected. The key risk here, I think, is impersonation. Right? So how can we make sure that when you talk to a bot, you know that you're talking to a bot, and when you're talking to a human? I actually took Asimov's rule and actually turned them into a bot set of rules. So, like, a bot should not impersonate a human. A bot should not hurt another human. Yep. So this, there are other questions around here about how can bot become better for humanity rather than, like, does the bot serve me or does the bot serve the service? So there's ethical questions associated with that as well.
Building AI responsibly is deeply important. Elon Musk said it's as dangerous as nuclear weapons, and I think that's farther off than where we are today, what we're using AI for. We think about AI in terms of helping uplift human intelligence, so we call it human augmented artificial intelligence. We're actually building for the humans. And I think if you think of it that way and you continue to differentiate the bot, we're always very clear about when Sensei is talking to you and very, very flat out that Sensei is a dumb bot, that the humans are what's actually powering the intelligence on the other side.
Yeah, I think the somewhat incomplete or misunderstanding of what AI is actually probably even more dangerous than what AI really can do also. So there is a lot of kind of FUD about AI
So you guys opened Pandora's box on this. I wasn't going to go there yet. I had this another half hour.
I was waiting to get you active, Matt. So, I wanted to see a little action.
Okay, so you guys opened the box. Let's talk about this. So originally software was eating the world, right? Then AI was going to eat software. And if AI is fundamentally evil, which some people are saying, then is the world just dust, right? Are we done? So you guys have all kind of mentioned that there's some FUD, there's augmentation, it's the people-to-people, kind of connection. So I'm going to give you guys an example real quick. I just want to see your reaction to this and then talk about, how do we use machine learning for good versus other things. So most of the people in the room have not had a chance to play with one of our HoloLens devices. There are a few people in the room that have. We have a number of devices out in the community right now. I saw a very interesting experiment that was conducted 2 days ago at a children's hospital using an augmented reality device. There were kids that were being studied that were having nightmares. And my son, my 11-year-old son, has had night tremors in the past. Anybody who's had a son who's had night tremors or a daughter, you understand that they wake up with full emotion of whatever they just experienced, but they're still living in the dream. It is a lifelike dream that they cannot be snapped out of without like a warm washcloth, put them in the rain, put them in the shower, things like that. So these people are doing research where they're taking full three-dimensional images and inserting them into a child's field of view. And on one hand, they're trying to see how that brain connection is for a dreamlike state. So if you do this with a child who's somewhat asleep versus wide awake, do they view that as reality or do they view that as, I know that's not real. If I reach out there, I won't be able to touch it. And they're putting in fuzzy, cuddly things. But as a control, they're also putting in like things that, like beasts that don't exist that would probably scare the heck out of a five-year-old. And so you look at that and you go, that's research. And the kid's been told ahead of time that they might see things that are scary and their mom's right with them and stuff like that, so they're okay. But imagine a world where bots are being trained to create chaos or havoc or scary situations or scary answers on the end of a human communication. Is there anything that you guys have thought about that's, like, how is society gonna catch itself before it crosses that line? Because it seems like it would be pretty easy to do. Right? We can use AI today to create very scary responses to really intimate questions.
How does society not create the Death Star?
Exactly.
Right, I mean, I think there's always a duality between everything. We give people open access to all information. Hackers then can open it up and exploit it. I think that it's always going to exist. So to me, the thing that is dangerous, actually you're right, the AI is not dangerous. The humans behind AI can be dangerous, and that's the responsibility that we have. It's maintaining human dignity is, you know, the first step, and I think that teaching everyone where the differences are, there's a lot of fear in AI. We were talking about how agriculture is going to be radically transformed in the coming years, and that might completely take over the majority of agriculture jobs. That sounds like a very scary thing. So all of a sudden, I have a fear-based response to AI in general, because I think AI is what is driving the labor force and you know, my very family being put out. So I think it's a matter of education, but how do we stop the Death Star from being constructed when hackers have the ability to do so?
Especially when we create really nice interfaces through Slack for them.
So I don't think AI is evil. I don't think AI is bad. I think AI is a tool. And you can use a tool to do good things, and you can use a tool to do bad things, right? So we have atomic energy, and it's good, and we have atomic bombs, and we sometimes use it for bad things. I think this is a technology, and like everything, this is a debate I have with my wife all the time. Like, I don't believe that technology is evil. Any technology is evil. You could use technology for good, and you can use AI for amazing things. There's a startup called Zebra that uses AI to analyze imagery, X-ray imagery, mm-hmm. to do better image recognition than any doctor could ever do. You would want to have that AI help you, right? This is not an evil AI. That you could use the same AI to target you to do ads, right? And that's questionable. Is that good? Is that bad? But again, it's what we do, it's what this room will do that will determine if we use AI to the good and the bad. That's
so,
my point.
And before you answer, I want to give you a chance to answer. But so if I just poke at that for a second, the hammer's getting bigger though, right? It used to be that we were giving people small hammers and it took a lot of pounding to actually to do evil, right? Now it's like one evil AI could impact a lot of people, right?
You still have to be very smart to make an evil AI.
Yeah, I mean, true.
At its core, but I think so. Let's empower everyone to be better humans. Give them the tools to do that. Maybe that's where it starts. Maybe this is a social conversation, and we're going into social good and change. Yeah.
So this is the optimist in the human race versus maybe some of the pessimism. But
it's my responsibility.
It's the Spider-Man motto, right? You know, there's a lot of power that is being created. You have to be very responsible with that power. But your point is very valid, though, which is internet connectivity, the fact that everything is connected, you know. So there are more places where people can get to or more things that can break. All of that creates an environment where more things could go wrong. And so,
I don't disagree, but I don't agree 100%. I think there's, as society, we need to make sure that this goes the right direction. I agree.
Yeah.
And there are new ethical challenges. For example, a car that has AI, yeah. And there's like a kid that runs into the road, and now the car has a billion choice, right?
Yeah.
To go to the pavement and kill you and save the boy, or to hit the boy and then save you. And yeah. It pretty much knows the outcome of both scenarios, right?
Yeah.
With pretty much accuracy. Now it's us or government or someone to make the choice. Again, the car will never be ethical, right? The person who's programming the car, who does the if kid, then continue onto the pavement, that's the ethical choice.
And interesting that you go there. So it's the Bay Area, so this is an easy question to ask. How many of you have been stuck behind a Google car? How many got frustrated by that experience? So I live in Mountain View. I'm frustrated almost every day by this. Because of some of the choices they're making on safety, just two examples, a right-hand turn at a four-way stop sign with four cars coming at the same time will almost baffle the crap out of the car, okay? A blinking red light, for all of you that remember your California driver's test, a blinking red light means come to a stop, then proceed. For some reason, that baffles, again, the car. So again, for safety, they've overprogrammed it, right?
Is that evil?
It's frustrating. It may not be evil, but it's frustrating.
Yeah, so the point, I don't think we are disagreeing on this one. What I'm saying is there are more places where this can create frustration or unhappiness. And so what is the counter for that? There is really no, you know, silver bullet for it. There is no, you know, top-down enforcement of some, you know, Asimov's laws.
Yep.
There is really no good way for you to design, you know, some, like, science fiction laws that permeate everything, right? So, but the most powerful thing here is just us, people, right? Like, developers actually understanding, right? Like, what are the best practices with building, you know, bots or software? Users understanding what their privacy rights are, what their, you know, what they truly expect from these things. Having a better sense for, you know, what the behavior of some of these technologies looks like, so that they can distinguish between bad behavior and good behavior. So there is a lot of education that needs to happen. I don't think there is any other way in which we can actually enforce, you know, some sort of top-down way of protecting people from the bad of technology or anything else for that matter.
And I think you're right. I think what gets interesting is, it's clearly the humans. A line of code is never inherently evil or good. It can be efficient or inefficient.
Yep.
That we do control that, or we think we do at times.
How you execute it.
Right.
Yep. Really.
You're right. It does come down to the people. The question is, are we supplying more power per interface than we were in the past? Mm-hmm. And you could argue the answer to that is yes.
Yep.
In almost everything we create.
Yep.
I think the big crime is actually, you know, and by the way, I do not see hackers as a negative thing. I know I said that word, but I think everyone should be and is in essence a hacker of something. There's something that you're passionate about and there's something that you're really geeky on. That I think is a hacker of all types of life. Just breaking the confines of system and creating something awesome. I do think that the big crime is going to be when the accessibility happens to create bots and everyone decides that they need a MeBot, which is essentially a selfie in a bot form, and then it talks on your behalf, and you know, you integrate it into your Facebook. The really big thing is when you said, you know, bots on bots. What happens when you have a bot that you smartly program to say happy birthday to everyone that you know on their birthday on Facebook because you're awesome, and you give them a randomized gift so that it looks like you, and then their bot sends you a gift saying thank you because they've programmed it. So, you know, we go through this back and forth process of where does the humanity end up coming in at that point in time. So build bots responsibly. If you have a MeBot, make it for a good purpose. There was one that was just built recently from someone that had her resume completely turned into a bot. She's had 20,000 installs, I think, so far on Facebook. And it was simply so that she could stop answering the same questions over and over and over and over and get people down to that 80% point when they wanted to make a decision. So she made a very smart bot. That was a really good idea.
Until everybody has one of those.
Yeah.
Well, it's when you, and then it's a pull. It's like going to your website. So everybody has a website. Everybody has a blog. Everybody has a Twitter. You know, everybody has a bot is okay as long as our bots are not spamming everybody.
Yeah, I think that spamming is one issue. Ads is another issue. Mm-hmm. So if the bot becomes the new pixel, we have a problem, right? If the bot learns you and then sends you ads, that's for me, that's an ethical problem. I want the bot to serve me rather than the service. Yeah. So that's another like big ethical issue. Who does the bot serve? And there's a lot of emotions here. I've been talking to bot creators, and they go through the logs of what people say to the bot. And it's mostly a lot of the things are irrational, right? They're asking the bots to do things that the bots were not programmed to.
They're hackers.
There's tons of swear words and tons of love words. There's wedding offers. And like, so people have of this relationship with the bot, which is much more than you would have with an app, right? So I would want to have an ads-free world for bots. I think that's one of my inspirations.
I'm with you on that one.
So. Don't create bots for ad delivery.
Please.
It's a lesson to them.
Do it when the person polls.
Yes.
It's a poll bot.
It's a difference.
When
if they ask, sure.
It,
that's different.
When I ask for it, and if you're smart about delivery, you will get the consumer at the purchase point. You'll get them at the point of intent.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
the most important point.
So let me ask you this. So I get the opportunity in my job just to work with startups all over the United States. And there is a difference between the LA ecosystem and the San Francisco ecosystem. But let's focus on this one for a second. Most founders here are technical, right? We go to New York and what we see are most founders are people trying to disrupt a market and the first person they want to hire is an engineer to go build whatever great idea they had. So, but if we're talking about here, what are some of the key technologies that you guys see playing into this kind of bot ecosystem? I mean, we've got natural language interfaces, obviously. You know, do you guys have a preference for language? Are there certain platforms that are becoming better? UI design constructs. When you guys think of the technology behind bots, what is it that's kind of emerging that people should know?
So, do you want to go?
Sure. Simply for me, I think the big incumbents are going to be anything that removes a repetitive task across any industry. I think it starts with what we had talked about. So, data entry or any type of job that is highly, highly repetitive, we'll see customer service radically transformed. And it's that thing about getting you to 80% and then needing to move it to a human for the final 20%. We'll just see those things.
So I thought that you were asking about the stack.
I was looking stack
okay,
first.
So,
but
yeah, there you go.
For the stack, I think hosting is one thing. So where do I host my bots?
Yeah.
How do I script? And right now, everything is like caveman technology, right? Yep. We're still looking for the space. We're talking about spaceship. We're having like hammers and rocks and I'm going to build this with a spaceship with my rock, right? But this is right and evolves. So we'll see the spaceship soon. Mm-hmm. Scripting is also something really important. And people always like hire data analysts. I think people start hiring scripting people. Right, new UX will be built on like, how do I script? How do I talk in a great, delightful way how does the bot talk to the person? So you need hosting, you need script. Sometimes you need AI. I would say that like about 70% of the time you won't need AI. For most of the services, you won't need AI. You'll need some sort of smart pattern recognition, maybe, or like regex on steroids. Then you need probably some framework, open source framework for like creating the conversation. So we partnered with Howdy to create BotKit, and you've been working with them as well, so in Microsoft and other partners. So we have an actual Node.js framework for building bots, and it supports things like hear, like say, like start a conversation, things that are a little bit more complex, and it's a great framework.
Yeah, so when we set out wanting to enable developers and startups to build bots. These were all the types of things that we wanted to help solve. And so the bot framework actually has three distinct components. So the bot SDK is what anybody can use to go. It's an open source SDK that's on GitHub. You can go build your own bot. It's platform agnostic, and you can it supports right now like the much of the code there. You can either use Node.js or .NET to build your bots. There's a bot connector, and this was one of those questions about like where are your users and where do you want to send these messages to? So the bot connector was, the goal for bot connector is to try to enable tons of channels. So you can write your bot once and then you can kind of register it onto the bot connector and have it enable a bunch of channels. So you can go to Slack, you can go to Kick and all kinds of other channels, Facebook. And there's also a direct line interface. So if you might not choose to go to a channel, or you might use a channel for a notification, but most of the real engagement you want to have direct with the customer on your user on your website, so you can build your own interface. And then there's a directory where you can kind of expose your bot to people. So the point about AI is very, very real. The level of sophistication that you need in your bot will vary widely. And there are some places where, you know, things like Lewis, which is the language understanding intelligence service, allows you to go from like having, say, a Wumpus bot where you actually have to put it. Does anybody heard Wumpus? One person here who knows what's Wumpus. Do you know Wumpus? Of course. So no one wants to date themselves. So Wumpus is a turn-based chat.
Well, let me just ask. You've never heard of twisty little passages all the same? Oh my goodness. So
yeah. So I've had the pleasure of being schooled on all of these classic games of the year. And Wumpus is one of those. And so it's like Dungeons and Dragons. You kind of go exploring. But in that game, in the original game, you have to be very rigid about what you say, right? Like, go to that room, and then it'll ask you what room, and then you have to say four or whatever. So you could use something like Lewis to actually build a very lightweight language model that allows you to start answering, like the user can start typing, take me to room four, and then it'll take you to room four. And you can say it in three or four different ways, and it'll still understand. So there is a set of cognitive services that are available, everything from pattern matching all the way to very sophisticated kind of language understanding. So pick and choose what tools you need and then kind of build your experience. So the one thing that I think everybody really needs is a designer. And the existing designers, I think, have to evolve. Because there's like visual designers and there are interaction designers. But there are no good conversation designers. So I think there is actually a really great opportunity in the design space for there to be conversation designers.
It's huge. Add conversational UI to your UX resume, and that will, like, you're going to go to the very top of every stack. We discovered this when we first started building our product. So we actually started in SMS because it was the easiest way to get an MVP out, proof of concept, really fast. We knew what we wanted to build. In the background, we had a UX designer and our, you know, core iOS developer working on a native app. And we scrapped it really, really quickly because we had massive traction in text. It was incredible for us. But we also realized, you know, we can basically work a workflow out and not really integrate a designer. Now we're in so many messengers that each one has nuanced features mm-hmm. and types of interfaces and buttons. And it isn't actually about the interface elements themselves. It is more about how you communicate with the user. So a good conversation is a design skill in yeah. and of itself. I think it's definitely going to be something that is going to be a big portion of user experience designers moving forward.
There's actually an IDE for conversation. It's yeah. called PulseString. It's from a company called ToyTalk mm-hmm. that created toys conversation. So like kids yeah. talking to toys. So they don't know. They when they came to me and they talked to me, they said, "We don't know anything about bots. We know everything about conversation." So they actually created now an IDE mm-hmm. to create conversation. So this is the level. This is the spaceships I'm talking about. They're coming, but yeah. they're still not there yet.
And there are some good APIs for NLP yep. as well. There's like wit.ai, I think Facebook yep. uses. There's api.ai, yep. which is very meta. Yeah. The thing about those, you will need someone to produce authority files. So you, if within your own business, depending on what you do, you're going to have to create all of the answers to everything that your customers need. So yeah. that's part of it is this ingest process, teaching your bot, do we really need that level of AI to really get us there? You know, how far do we go?
I mean, the biggest topic in the industrial research labs right now around machine learning and AI is how to democratize it, how to make it easier for people to use, how to make it so that you don't need a PhD to go build your models. And the good thing about it is that there are now enough efforts out there, ranging from our own cognitive services to, you know, some of the ones you mentioned, to try and make it, for at least for many of the scenarios that most of you would care about, that you can actually go far without having to hire a data scientist or a machine learning person.
Yeah, we talked about this when we talked about, like, a lot of people say, hey, I will give my AI a few examples and it will be okay. That's probably not going to happen, right?
No.
You need a big, big, big training set.
Yeah.
Another thing is, like, who owns the data?
Yep.
So all these APIs are great, but do I own the data set and the training set, or as a startup, or does the service own the data set? So that's another thing that we need to figure out as time passes.
So we've had to really think that through, because when we delivered the translation API to the world, the good thing, the reason why we could do that is because, you know, we have a search engine. And so because of that, we can learn from the world, like the entire web. And so we built like language models that actually understand language based on what they have learned from the web. And so the nice thing there is you actually can choose to use just the language models that Microsoft has, or you can bring in your own data and then let that data influence those language models. So if you're an enterprise and you have lots of interesting lingo and abbreviations, you know, you can go to the Translator Hub, upload that data, and then you can teach it that, hey, you know, we speak like this in our enterprise. And so it actually influences the weights in those statistical models in the bigger data set. And we're actually very, very clear and very explicit about who owns what data and creating a separation between like your data and the web data. So.
This is an opportunity, too, for integrating delight. Like, a few examples won't work because humans are naturally smart and curious,
yes,
and we're hackers. I've asked Echo every possible question I can, and when people come to my house, I'm surprised at how many more things they come up with to ask it as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, you have to sort of build that in and think about all of the possible ranges. Siri continues to impress, kind of surprise and impress me, but you know, it still is a very, very, very shallow layer. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of thinking to do.
I have a friend who works in the Siri, and he's been telling me that, like, looking at the conversations, a lot of it's really sad. It's like there's old people who have like lengthy conversation with Siri because they're alone. So having like turning this into like something that improves humanity for these audiences, I've seen startups that connect elderly with that are out there in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
with people in South America, the kids that want to learn English, so they're creating the conversation between these audiences. So we have the opportunity. We're always talking about the bad aspects of AI. We have the opportunity to actually improve humanity through bots.
Yeah, and so and there were a bunch of things in there that we could dive deep on, but the one that I want to hit on that one for just a second, because there was a startup in Palo Alto. They actually got bought by a toy company. They bought by Mattel. But what they did is they created it was supposed to look like a bear, but it was more of a generic stuffed animal. And the whole point is they put a natural language interface in this thing with a little bit of machine learning.
Mm-hmm.
So it would learn the kid's name, but it was there for autistic kids. And the idea was to engage at the level that the kid wanted to engage with the toy. And the beautiful thing about this is that they studied, that Princeton did a study on this for about 6 months. The toy actually increased the adaptability of the child to the outside world by over 200% over the period of the time that the child was willing to engage just with the toy. Because if the child was willing to engage with the toy, the child was willing to engage with somebody else as well.
Yeah.
And it would always test it out on this very safe, inanimate object, mm-hmm, that was somewhat intelligent. Would always, and they, of course, the machine language part of it, or the machine learning part of it, was always a positive reinforcement of that exploration, mm-hmm, right? And it was an amazing experience. And to see that video and to see the difference in the kids was tremendous. So these kind of things, clearly great opportunities. So let's just touch on, I want to come back to what you said, because I think a lot of people don't understand exactly what you guys were able to do with the translation service.
Mm-hmm.
So put that in the context of bots for a second. What you're saying is that there's going to be a point in the future where we won't just be able to translate one bot from one messaging service to another bot and another messaging services, but you'll be able to translate across languages.
Yep.
So across cultures.
Mm-hmm.
So say a little more about that.
Yeah. So one of the challenges always has been that you have so many technologies that are involved in getting people to communicate with each other in two different languages that everything was very black boxed, right? Like you would take speech recognition, you take machine translation, you take text synthesis, and then kind of put them together. And we've just never had the right level of quality to actually create any kind of a reasonably human experience. The nice thing about all the increases in computing power, the ability to actually process lots of data, this whole area of deep learning, what it did was it really pushed the envelope far on speech recognition and on machine translation. So in speech recognition today, we can actually detect like our word error rate, which is how we measure how accurate the speech recognizer is better than human beings. So if you or I mean, not trained like interpreters, right? But if you or I were to just listen to somebody just speak and you were writing it down, you would make more mistakes than the technology. So when we arrived at that point, it became a really interesting problem to go and how do we combine these technologies? And it was not enough to still do this black box type of thing. We had to kind of think about the whole experience. And like I said earlier, we had to kind of forget about exposing this technology to the end user. I mean, we were trying to put this in Skype. And Skype is this completely minimalist view where it puts the other person in full screen and it's really about, you know, those conversations. And when we did the early tests, we were surprised by what people do on Skype. Right? Like people sing to each other on Skype. Like they just leave it on and, you know, are shouting at each other from different parts of the house. And so it had to deal with all of that, right? And we actually started off designing it like a bot, like as if it had a personality and you would actually, it would be a interpreter that sat in the room type of thing. And with these experiences, having looked at how people interact with each other, it became clear that we needed to kind of integrate it very deeply into the background. And also like design features that understood what people were trying to do. Making people listen to the original language, right? And being able to pay attention to the other person's emotions or expressions. Like, you know, if you're squinting at it and not sure what it said when it made a mistake, giving a very easy way for people to repeat what they said. So we had to learn a lot of that from users, from actually working with users. And so this technology has kind of taught us a lot about how AI needs to kind of go into the background most of the time. If it doesn't simplify something that you're trying to do, don't do it, right? And we also had to learn how people, like all the slang and all these ums and ahs that we do, prosody, it can't just detect that and assume that there is meaning there. But then there's also a research problem there, which is there are sometimes your pauses or your fillers actually have actual meaning. And if we eliminate that in the process of translating, what meaning are we losing? Right. So it's an ongoing research as well.
It's an interesting problem. So let's go to Slack for a second.
Yep.
When you think of the future a little bit, right? Both near future and far future, your main focus has been to make that communication between teams easier.
Yeah. Right. Inside teams for
business. Inside teams. Right. Exactly. So when you look at that, how much efficiency both have you seen already, and how much efficiency do you think there's more to get out of that when you think about that team interaction?
I would say we're at like 5% of efficiency that we can get into. I think that the key is that you can install Slack, and on top of Slack, you install all these tools and services that you use for work, and then you communicate with them. And if you go, as entrepreneurs, I call upon you to go into our Slack app directory to see what's there, but more importantly, see what's not there, right? There's tons of opportunity. It's very, very greenfield. Right now, we don't have a sales category, for example. So there's like tons of opportunity of looking at, and I used to work in Android Play, and people actually looked at Google Play and analyzed what's not there, what's missing, right? And look at other markets and compare between markets and see what's happening and successfully in one market that could be moved into another market. So doing a greenfield analysis, there's a lot of greenfield. I would say maybe 5% even is even optimistic. There's tons of opportunity to happen there still.
And when you think of Sensei, it's about connecting the people together. In the end, that's what it is, right? And you're getting rid of all those shallow conversations so you can actually get to a deeper one, or at least one with more meaning. Is there a network effect in that? Have you guys explored that? Like, when you connect two people together across a network of potentially thousands of people, or tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, is there get to be value about the number of people in the network, or is it just about that connection between two people?
So we hit over 1 million users at the end of last year in SMS alone, and the network effect relates to latency and speed. So as humans are available and more people know or are knowledgeable about certain things, you can route it faster. So on Sensei now, our average response time is about 90 seconds or less, which is across anything. You can basically ask for anything that you need to know about, and when it's highly saturated, it's going to be very, very, very fast. So, you know, obviously here, if it's related to startups or tech or anything of that nature, also when it's something that is advice-driven. So everyone has an opinion, and everyone has a lot of life experience. When it's something where another person needs motivation for the day, they need relationship advice, they need just another human to connect with, even the elderly patients, mm-hmm. you know, who need that human connection, another person is generally willing to jump into that conversation really quickly. So the more we have using the product and the more people that we have with more specific knowledge, the better the results will be, because we'll be able to get you to someone who truly is deeply knowledgeable, as well as the faster the results will be.
Do you have kids asking homework questions on there yet?
All the time. So we launched in Kick because we have a huge, huge demographic of younger users. Naturally, teenagers, and the reason I think that they understood Snapchat before anyone else, when no one could figure out that interface, they're curious, yeah. right? And so they're the ones that try to break interfaces or just play with them until they figured out everything. They are expecting to have an Easter egg. So our teenage demographic does use it for useful things. They use it for homework advice, and they're connecting to a UCLA student. And this is a pretty big thing, because that would not typically be a person that they would have access to. So it's kind of like micro-mentorship, and the time that you give feels really good. So for me, I did this talk at South by Southwest about gratitude. It's almost gratitude as a service. The gratitude layer of it and that feeling that you get, you're actually banking good emotion by helping other people. And all around, I think that the ripple effects of that are just uplifting humanity in general.
That's very cool. Okay, so we've got a few minutes left. Want to give you guys a shot to ask any questions you've got of the panelists. We've got a microphone in the center. I'm looking for the first volunteer to step to the microphone with a question to wow and amaze us and take this a little deeper. We've got a first person walking up.
I like the Occupy Mars shirt. It's SpaceX.
All right. My question is, with all these bots being created, you know, somebody kind of said, like, you know, with 8,000 bots out there in the world, which one at what point can help you? I guess kind of the thought about it is, like, this guy was building an app where it was like one big bot that kind of like maybe connected to other bots. So I guess the thing is for you guys, like, if everybody's creating these bots, like, maybe is there a shared knowledge? Like, what are you guys' thoughts around actually making a smart single bot?
So I think that the core is the platform. Like, where do you spend the majority of your time? And that's probably a messenger. And it might be SMS, and it's probably not. It's probably Facebook Messenger or WhatsApp or Skype or Slack or maybe a combination of all of them. And it's really about bringing the bots into the place that I am the most frequently. So there are bot, I don't know if you would call it a, maybe it's like a mega bot. It's the meta bot. There's a bot for the purpose of having other bots inside of it. And I think fundamentally that doesn't work, because we're not likely to download an app or another platform that we don't spend a lot of time in. And that's why I think Slack was tremendously successful, because it all of a sudden gave me this opportunity to do everything I needed to do within a tool I was already spending a good chunk of my time in, just like Google Chrome plugins did for the browser.
Yeah, I mean, one bot to rule them all is actually, you know, not that effective. But if you're looking at different segments, the Slack example is fantastic, because, you know, they have a pretty clear focus on what the audience is. And so if you're really going after that audience, it's obvious that you need to be on Slack, right? And so the nice thing that I also see here is there is bot-to-bot interaction that needs to be figured out to make it work well. But when that really works well, I think there is actually the possibility that you're just talking to one bot, but that bot might actually go to multiple bots to accomplish a lot more for you. And so that might be the meta part of it,
yep,
rather than somebody writing one bot that does everything.
Hi, quick question just regards to your point about machine learning, the number of data points that you need. So one of the things that we want to integrate into our systems is automated crop health analysis. And one of the things we're going to need to do is take many, many photos of crops in different health states to build that. What would you say is kind of a minimum number of data points to get kind of statistically significant information so that we're, you know, providing good value there?
You want to take that?
Yeah, if you want.
Yeah. Well, we can both
answer.
So it really depends on what you're trying to do. If you are trying to build on top of existing knowledge, right? Like if it is a recognition of something specific happening to the crop, and that knowledge, there's really nothing out there, right? Like there's no pre-existing imagery of that kind, then you actually need quite a few data points. There is some research work going on right now in sparse extracting insights from sparse data, but really, like, most of the top level machine learning work right now is all with, you know, large amounts of data. I will use the speech analogy because it's kind of similar. We needed to do a kind of a minimum of about 5,000 hours of speech transcribed in order to get to a reasonable quality, right? Like nowhere near top notch, but for you, you might not need like 100% accuracy. And so from that point of view, I think that would be kind of the range for, on the speech side. So I would expect something similar on the...
I would say a lot is the right answer. how much a lot is accuracy, variance in data. So how many options are there? Quality of the data.
Mm-hmm.
So how good the quality is. The startup that I talked about, Zepra, they bought 40 years of actual imagery from one of the HMOs, right?
Yeah.
They anonymized it and they used like, so if you have training data that you can like steal from other resources, that's a great way to hack. Like starting to train from zero is probably very expensive for a startup.
How many dogs did you have to, how many data points on dogs for the portion?
It was in the millions,
yeah,
right? And because part of it is when people take a picture, they're not taking the picture from just in the front, like, you know, with good lighting. So all these variations, like lighting and angle and all of that factor in. And so you're looking at millions of data points.
So basically crowdsource it from every agriculture worker before their jobs are taken over by robots.
Yeah.
other value.
Or turn them into picture takers.
Well, that's the thing. So maybe you're shifting their role. Give them value for that. If you give them a microtransaction per picture, you've just increased their wage.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. you're essentially saving their job.
So build drones with good cameras and then hand the controllers to those folks.
Ooh, yeah. Even better.
By the way, for imagery, it's much more complex. For text, it's much easier.
Yeah.
And if you have a DSL, domain-specific language, like business,
mm-hmm.
it's much, much easier.
Yeah.
So the more focus you bring it, the better results you'll get from AI or any type of heuristic algorithms.
Yeah, for that translation hub that I was talking about, you could even have just a dictionary of about 1,000 terms or 2,000 terms, and then put it on top of the existing kind of web knowledge, it actually performs much better. So.
That's a great question. We have time for one more question. Anybody willing? Got one? Going once, going twice?
I can.
Okay, well, I was gonna say, yeah. I'm gonna give you guys each a chance to kind of close here. Go any way you want, and we've had some great learnings. You know, bots aren't necessarily evil. It's the humans behind them that could be. So, do we have one more?
Yeah,
yep.
Go for it.
So somebody created a bot that listens to a conference call, and whenever their name is mentioned, gives them transcript for 15 seconds, and then it says, hey, sorry, I thought the microphone was on mute, and then lets them to go in and respond to the question. Is it considered to be evil or genius?
I guess it's the eye of the beholder.
Yeah, that's
well,
right.
Yes. Evil and genius don't have to be a different thing.
That's right, exactly.
$1 billion.
So why don't we just start? Let's close. So we. you know, it's been it's been very interesting. I think we've all I've learned some things. That's great. What would you close with? Let's start on the side.
Well, I mean, I think so. It seems like a room full of entrepreneurs and people who are deeply interested in innovation and technology. So, I think embark on your own personal journey of figuring out what you can do and create given the tools that are out there. We've had things like If This Then That for ages, and if you've used those things in your daily life, it's actually made you more awesome. To the people around you who see how responsive you are in your text or when you check in on Slack, like when I come into the range of my office, it says, you know, Crystal's in the building. We do these small tips and tricks within our own lives. Figure out how to automate the processes in your life that are inhibiting you from doing the things that you really love. Get more time back, and I think that you'll start to find that you can figure out how to integrate bots and AI into your own life. Also use Sensei to figure out how your knowledge can be useful to someone else, and maybe you'll learn something, maybe you'll teach someone else something.
Do I have 2 minutes for experiments?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I need a volunteer. Come to stage, please. Is it okay, Radical?
Yeah, go,
okay,
go for it.
Hi.
Well, let me ask. You're not going to hurt him?
No, going to hurt him.
Okay.
So we're going to do an experiment, okay? I'm going to be the service. You're going to be the user, okay? Hi. I'm a service. Hi. Nice to meet you. I'm a great service, but before I tell you what I do, I want your username and password for Facebook. Please. Please. And then you get my
so
service.
No, I have to. I usually say no.
No, you say no. Okay. You saw that people interacted. This was, thank you.
Sure. That's it.
Yes. Yeah.
My point is, even if you're not considering bots, turning your service into a conversation will make it a better service, right? So think about how you turn your service into a conversation, even if you're not thinking about bots. You saw that this was like you predicted that he would say no, right? Very easily. Why so many apps have a login wall? And before they show you what the app actually does, it actually asks you to log in and to give the credentials, right? So if we can, as product managers, as entrepreneurs, if we can turn everything into a conversation, I usually, when I do mentorship sessions, I say, talk to me your app, talk to me about your service. And you learn a lot from this simple conversations, right? We've been building UXs for
Well, that panel was amazing.